Hey, welcome everybody. Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight's speaker is Ray S. I met Ray this weekend at the Rock, the Atlanta Men's Workshop at Rock Eagle, Georgia, the 4-H Center. And we were in the same cabin. And one of the things after Friday night barbecue before the speaker, we have a little cabin meeting and everybody tells their AA story. It's brief and to the point. Ray had an amazing passion, and I asked him if he would come and tell his story. And initially we had him pegged for April 18th. Then he got bumped because we had another speaker who was having a birthday. 21 years at that time. So he was very gracious and said he would do it on May 4th. And our scheduled speaker, Russ, got waylaid with work, couldn't come down tonight, and called Ray S., explained it was a God thing, and here he is. Welcome, Ray.
Hi, my name is Ray, and I'm a real alcoholic. I don't say that to make it anything different, but that's how it defines it in the big book when you drank the way I drank. So, my sobriety date is June 29th, 2014. I'm going to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I want to tell you a little bit just before I was born to kind of explain the unmanageability of what I was born into. My mother was from Ohio, and my father was from Maine. And my father, he was a runaway. My grandfather was an alcoholic, and he molested my aunts, and he blew his brains out. So my dad ended up in Florida, and him and my horny uncle saw some woman hitchhiking down around Lake City, Florida. That happened to be my mother, so they turned around. So that's the kind of chaotic stuff that my family did. All right, well, my father was also a career criminal, and he ended up having warrants in the state of Georgia, Florida, and Ohio. So when my mother was pregnant with me, they went to Maine. That's where I was born, although he still ended up in jail while I was born. When I was about 6 months old, we left, and we swung through Ohio, and then we moved down to Brunswick, Georgia. And that's where my first memories of life were. I remember that my father ran over my cousin's Tonka truck, and I remember having my first drink of alcohol. So my entire life, that's all I knew. My father was kind of, he never hit us kids, but he was kind of violent with my mother. I can remember seeing him come in drinking and knocking my mother over the coffee table. And, you know, and he was always like in and out of jail and stuff like that. And so my mom told him, she's like, if you go to jail one more time, just let me know where you're at, and me and the kids are going to Ohio. And that's where we went. We went to Ohio. It wasn't long after that, my mom met my stepdad. And my stepdad was everything that my father wasn't. He wasn't a criminal. He had a stable job. He had his own house. He had all that stuff. But he was also violent with us kids. So he used to beat me pretty bad. He broke my collarbone, broke my nose, many trips to the hospital and stuff like that. And he was always drinking. He used to beat us, and then he would make us smoke weed with him so we would fall asleep. And so that's all I knew was like drugs, alcohol, and violence, you know, from as long as I can remember. And so, like, you know, the abuse kind of went on for a couple of years. You know, I'd say a couple, about 4 or 5. I think I was maybe 9, 10 years old or so. The last time he hit me, he said, he goes, "If you want to be like your biological father, I guess I can't beat it out of you." And then he just stopped, you know. And, you know, so I don't really remember a whole lot over the next couple of years. You know, I mean, I just tried to block everything out. But I do know when I got to middle school, I started drinking. I started hanging out with the older kids, and that's because, you know, I mean, they were the ones doing the stuff that I had seen growing up, and I was like, well, I want to try some of that. You know, so that's who I went and I hung out with. And when I was in 7th grade, it had been about 5 years since my biological father had been around. And all of a sudden, he just popped up, and I was going to go down to Florida with him to visit for the summer. My brother was going to move down there. And so he came and got us, and we all rode down there. Somehow, a turn of events happened, and my brother ended up moving back to Ohio, and I ended up staying. And I was right where I wanted to be. I could smoke cigarettes, and I could drink. You know, my dad thought it was funny that I was drinking Budweiser's and shots of Jim Beam at 13 years old. You know, at 13 years old, I was in full-blown alcoholism. You know, I couldn't think of doing much else. All I wanted to do was drink. I didn't want to have a drink. I wanted to get totally annihilated. So that's what I did at every opportunity I had. I ended up getting in a fight with my father, and I was like, you know what, screw you, I'll go back to Ohio. And he's like, is that what you want? And he took me right to the airport, like right that very moment, put me on a plane, and flew me back to Ohio. So, I mean, once again, you know, old dad just said to hell with me, and I guess I was okay with that. I mean, I didn't really care. I mean, at that point, I was already numb to everything, you know. I had been abused so much physically, sexually, just whatever happened in life, I just assumed that those were the things that happened to everybody, you know. And I was always told not to talk about it, so I just kind of never did, you know. I remember that first time I took that drink when I was in Brunswick, Georgia. And I don't remember feeling warm and fuzzy or anything like that. But what I do remember is I remember fitting in. I remember that I got to be like a part of what Dad was doing. I was one of the guys. And that seemed to have seemed to carry on as I got older. I started high school. In 9th grade, I was suspended 13 times my freshman year. My sophomore year, I was suspended 10 times in the first semester, then expelled. And I didn't care because all school was doing really was getting in the way of my drinking. You know, that's all I wanted to do. And so that's what I did. And then the summer going into my junior year, my parents knew that they couldn't stop me from partying. They knew I was going to do it. So it was the 4th of July weekend, and they thought the best thing to do would be to take me with them and let me drink with them. That way, at least I was monitored. Well, you know, I always thought that my parents were alcoholic, but as I look back on it, you know, they stopped drinking. You know, like I can recall them stopping drinking and going to bed. You know, so we had some Jello shots and some drinks and passed some other things around the circle, and I was having fun. I don't remember what time it was, but I knew that we went home, and we got there, and I'm like, I know there's some parties going on somewhere. You know, so I was like, I'm just going to wait for my parents to fall asleep, and I'm going to steal the car. So I didn't have a driver's license or anything like that. When I was like 15 years old, I had already lost the privilege to get my license until I was 18. And that was probably smart, you know, on the judge's part. But so what ended up happening is I army crawled across my mom's floor, and I took the keys out of her purse. And I went looking for a party, and I got somewhere, and all there was like a tipped over keg and a bunch of empty cups everywhere. Nobody was there. I'm like, so I continued to go somewhere else, and I finally found somebody that said, yeah, man, I know where they're partying. And so he got in the car with me, and we were leaving, and we were headed down the road, and I remember seeing a cop at the stop sign, and I passed him, and I saw his turn signal switch. And he got behind me, and the guy with me was like, we're getting pulled over. I'm like, no, we're not. And he's like, yeah, we are. I was like, no, you don't understand. I'm like, I don't have a license. I stole this car. I'm not stopping. And so he's like, I just get out of town as fast as you can. Yeah. So I went to the next road. I turned. I stopped. I let the cop get out of the car, and I took off. I made it maybe half a mile, and I didn't even realize where I was at. I was on a street that I had walked up and down, like, all growing up. And I was in such a blur, I didn't know where I was. And I came up on an S-curve, and I spun out of control, and I wrecked into my high school. And they're trying to get me back in school, I don't know. But I managed somehow to not be injured with both axles off the car. The tires fell off the axles. All the windows were broken. The rearview mirror is laying in the back seat. And I climb out through a broken window, and I take off on foot. I ended up stealing a bicycle, ditching the bicycle, hopping on the train tracks, getting down into a creek, thinking they're following me, and just like laying down in the water, you know, and just like easing down because the creek was going to come up right behind my house. I would go to any length for my freedom then. I didn't want to get arrested. I did not want to be taken away from the life I like to live. You know, so I did anything to get away, but when I got to the house, the police were there waiting for me. And for a long time, it was not my fault that they caught me. It was not my fault at all. I stole the car. My parents didn't see me take it. How could they have possibly known it was me? Yeah. I thought that the guy that was with me, it was his fault. Because he couldn't get away. So when the cops got him, he's like, oh, it was Ray. Ray Stickney was the one driving that car. You know. So for a long time, I blamed him for that. I ended up in a boys' home, and I was there for 13 and a half months. And we got to go out, and we got to go to work, and make money, and I found a way to get a second paycheck out of a kitchen that we were working in, and I used that money to supply my drinking and my smoking habits. And I remember one weekend I went out after work, and because they never knew at the group home exactly what time we got done. We got done when the kitchen was clean. You know, and then we would walk down the street back to the group home. And I talked somebody that worked there into buying me some beer afterwards. And I got totally shit-faced. And I woke up naked in the wrong room. So I got up in the morning, and I was like, I am not supposed to be in this room. And I got up, and I went back to my room. And then when I came downstairs, they confronted me about it. And I'm like, how did they know? I was like, you know, they didn't wake me up. They just let me sleep it off. Yeah, so this place had 5 levels, and you start on level 1, and after 2 weeks, you can get to level 2. And 13 and a half months, I never made it past level 2. It's a 6-month program, too. But they liked me, they kept seeing potential, but every time I would get anything stable in my life, I would just kick the legs right out from underneath it. Yeah, I ended up going back home, and I turned 18, and I thought 18 to me meant that I was free. I could do whatever I wanted. You know, my parents couldn't tell me what to do. I'm an adult, you know. All I was like a legal age kid, you know, is all it was. I think I was 18 for 2 weeks, and I was at a bonfire, and we were drinking, and this guy throws an aerosol can in the fire, and it explodes, and then shortly after that, I leave, me and 2 of my buddies, and I'm walking down the road, and I'm staggering, and the cops stop, and they want to search us for guns because somebody reported that they heard gunshots. So that was my first trip to jail for an underage drinking charge. And I swear to God I was going to kick this guy's ass when I got out of jail because it was his fault that I got arrested. Not that I was 18 and I was drunk in public, but because he threw an aerosol can in the fire. And if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't have went to jail. I got out of jail after a few days, and a few weeks later, I was with my brother, and he had a warrant for his arrest, and we got pulled over, and when they went to arrest him for the warrant, they smelled alcohol on him, and it was like, well, Ben, if you're drinking, I bet you Ray in the backseat, they knew me by name, yeah, I bet you Ray's drinking too, so I went to jail, and it was my brother's fault, you know. Because he's the one that had the warrant. If it wasn't for his warrant, I wouldn't have got arrested. It had nothing to do with the fact that I was drinking and I was 18 years old. So we go to court, and my brother is on domestic violence and his 6th underage drinking charge. And he went in and he said, not guilty. And the judge said, $1,000 on recognizance. Let him sign the paper and go. I'm like, well, I was drinking. There's just no way for me to get around this, you know. So I'm just going to say that I'm guilty. So I'm like, how do you plead? I'm like, guilty, Your Honor. He's like, 60 days in jail. Bam, I'm like, how does that happen? Like, you know, so I'm getting picked on. You know, they're going to make an example out of me. And so anyway, you know, that's just kind of how life was. You know, I mean, I drank to live. You know, lived to drink. That's what it was like. And I ended up getting in some other trouble. I was like 19 years old, and I got served with a felony indictment. And I didn't do it. I mean, I kind of had a part in it. But, you know, I was more of an accessory. Didn't actually commit the crime. But when I was in jail on an underage drinking charge, serving 6 months, the guy that did it switched his place and my place around. And, you know, they went with his story, and I ended up locked up for that. But it was all right. I mean, it put a little hiccup in my drinking. You know, I gained a little bit of weight. You know, I got a little bit of energy. I got right back out. I was drinking and smoking on the car ride out of the jail. And then a little more time went by, and I ended up with my second felony indictment. And I didn't do that one either. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. That one I did actually beat. I was going to take it to trial, but I did beat it. And for insufficient evidence against me. But at that point, I had turned 21, and I was getting arrested constantly for public intoxication. Cussing out the cops, you know, blah, 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 blah. I got a DUI. And then I got served with my third felony indictment. The first indictment, I got reduced down to a misdemeanor, receiving stolen property. The second indictment, I beat it. On the third indictment, I had been indicted for trafficking an ounce of cocaine that I did not sell, but I was in the spot with the guy. Not that I hadn't done a lot of things, but they weren't catching me ever for what I was doing. I kept getting in trouble because everybody else was a horrible criminal. You know, nothing to do with my own actions. And so all I wanted to do was, like, at this point, it has been like 9 years since I've seen my biological father. And he pops up out of the woodwork and was like, I'm in Georgia. I've got my own company. You should come down and come to work for me. And I was like, well, you know, I've got this stuff going on with court. And he's like, just come on down. Yeah, I'll remind you that my father was a career criminal and was always on the run. You know, so he taught me how to drink when I was 13, and now he was teaching me how to properly run from the law. You know, I thought he was the coolest guy around. I was like, sure. So I came up, I hopped on a Greyhound bus, and I came down to Marietta, Georgia, and that was in 2003. And then after being here for a few weeks, I kind of freaked out, and I called my attorney. He's like, you get your ass back to the Buckeye. I'll take care of the court. So I went back up there, and I was like, all right, so I want straight time. I don't want any probation. I don't care how long I have to sit in jail. I'm like, I just want straight time. I want to be able to move on with my life. At this point, I thought that there was something waiting for me in Georgia, you know, and this little court thing was just standing in the way. I never stopped drinking for any of it. I stopped doing anything else that I was doing, which a lot of times people that do other things say that alcohol is to them is just like a party favor. Alcohol has always been my drug of choice, and on occasions I had other party favors. Well, I ended up, they wouldn't give me straight time. They were like, you're going to serve 60 days in jail, because they reduced it from a felony 3 down to an M1. At that point, I should have just kept fighting it, you know. But I thought on a technicality, I didn't want to get locked up for 5 years. And that's exactly what would have happened if I had lost at trial. So I served my little bit of time. I got out. I hopped on a Greyhound bus, and I came down to Georgia. And I was down here for about 8-9 months. And I thought that everything had calmed down up there, and I could sneak up for a visit. And that wasn't the case. I was up there. I was drinking out in a buddy's front yard. So much for flying low-key. And I got arrested. Well, my father says, he calls up and talks to the court and says, what can we do to get him in Georgia? And they said, well, let's see. So they called Georgia. They said, we don't want him. We've got enough drug dealers of our own. You can keep him. So Ohio's like, all right, well, this is what we're going to do for you. If your dad will send us your 1/3 of the restitution, because my two co-defendants on the time I was on the run had already went off to prison, we'll let him come to Georgia. Every month he sends us a set of travel papers. Sends us the money, we'll send him a set of travel papers that permits him to be out of the state of Ohio. When we get all of our money, we'll dismiss the case as though it didn't happen on conditions he never moves back to the state of Ohio. I'm sold. There's nothing for me in Ohio. All I ever wanted to do was get away from the place. Yeah, so I came down here, and I thought that my dad was going to teach me how to drink responsibly. You know, he seemed like a functioning alcoholic, you know. And, I mean, he's like, you know, he'd say things like, you know, if I can't drink when I work, I fucking quit. You know, and I'm like, yeah, man, that's what I'm talking about, you know. So the thing of it is when I woke up in the morning, I wanted to drink, you know, and I couldn't function at work. And alcohol was my best friend, you know. Like, I went to it for everything. That was just, like, my thing to do. I didn't have to go anywhere to enjoy it. You know, I didn't have to have anybody around to enjoy it. You know, me and alcohol, we just had this nice little bond, you know. And so I thought that I was going to learn some things here. I didn't. In the process of all this, I was hanging out at this bar, and I had a sting for the bartender. And I was really good at telling lies and making my life seem like it was a lot better than it was. So I kind of hoodwinked this girl into being my hostage, so to speak. And we ended up having a kid, and but we didn't stay together. You know, like it was just kind of like this fling thing. And when the kid was about 10 months old, her and I did end up getting together. And you know, and she liked to drink too. She didn't drink every day the way I drank every day, but the days that she drank just the way I drank. And we ended up having another child, and I couldn't afford to keep my own place, you know. I spent all my money in the bars. I spent all my money out showboating, trying to make it look like I had some lavish life. I was trying to make myself fit in. I was wondering how all these other people were out here doing this in the bar, and they're surviving, they're keeping their homes. I was like, man, I'm just missing a certain link, you know. Eventually, I'm going to get this, you know, and I'll be able to drink the way I want to drink, and I will be able to function properly in society. I've always had a problem with comparing my insides to everybody else's outsides. I honestly don't know what kind of struggles these other people in the bars really went through in life. You know, I don't know that their life was as glamorous as I thought it was. You know, but I have a tendency of making things up in my own head, you know, and end up not being anything close to the truth. Well, we end up having a third child. And I'm living at my in-laws, you know. I'm telling everybody out, well, now I'm like, yeah, you know, the in-laws, they need some help, so I'm there. We're taking help take care of them and take care of the house and this and that. And I ain't none of that shit true, you know. But a lot of people was like, you know, that's, you're a really stand-up guy. You know, that's a really nice thing of you to do. You know, I was always getting credit for things I didn't deserve. My sister was killed in a car wreck in 2003, and I robbed her friends, the male ones. I slept with the female ones. I was nothing like what a big brother should be like. And my sister died, and I was a pallbearer at her funeral. And people were like, this is a really good thing you're doing for her. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, I know. I appreciate it. And but the fact of the matter is my sister hated me when she died. And that was something that I had to live with, you know. And I'm a pretty sick guy. When this happened, I did not, it wasn't like, I should stop drinking, you know, I should stop doing this. It was, this is an opportunity for to make people feel sorry for me, so that way they'll excuse my drinking, and that way they'll buy me booze, go into the bar, my sister just died, oh man, that really sucks, dude, here, let me buy you a drink. That's how sick I am, you know. That same year, 2003, I burned my parents' house to the ground, and I almost died. And that didn't, nothing registered. It was bad luck, you know, it was bad luck. The cigarette rolled out of the ashtray. I didn't just leave it on the floor. You know, that was bad luck that happened, you know. And I would make people feel sorry for me. That's just how it was, you know. I mean, I couldn't keep it straight ever. And, it was in June of 2014. I was starting to know that everything that was going on in my life was my fault. It's all my fault. I'm a piece of shit. And I can't change it. I can't stop drinking. This is ridiculous. My wife would say, I know you can stop. I've seen you do it before. I'm like, what, for 2 days? For 2 days? You know? the book talks about we can't bring into consciousness with sufficient force the pain and suffering of a week or a month ago. I was blown away that somebody could make it a week without a drink when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like, who the hell can go a week? I sure can't. I woke up in the middle of the night drinking. 3 a.m. shaken. I had liquor bottles hidden in the kitchen cabinets, underneath the bathroom cabinets, in the baby stroller, on my trailer, in the bushes. And if I couldn't find one, I was freaking out. And my dad lived a half a mile from me, and he kept a stock bar at his house. And there's been many times at 3:30 in the morning, I'm banging on his window. Like, I need something to drink. You know? And he'd give me a 12-pack and a fifth of liquor. I'd be like, I want my liquor back. I don't want any money. Tomorrow you go to the store and replace my stuff. And I always made sure I did that. You know, my phone bill might be late. I might not have insurance on the car. But I made sure that I got back over there and gave him his shit because that was what I was going to need the most. And I was doing this job where I was painting the interior of a house. And this lady is leaving town for 5 days. I mean, the house is empty. But the homeowner is like, she's going to be out of town. I've only got like a couple hours worth of work left to do. We'll square up on the job when she gets back. And I'm like, well, I don't really have any need to get right over there and finish this off. You know, I've got some money. I'm going to go out and drink. I'm going to have a good time. And then it gets to the weekend, and I'm like, all right, I'm going to go over this weekend. I'm just going to knock out that couple hours worth of work. I couldn't do it. Sunday morning came around, and she was coming back on Tuesday. And I woke up at 7 o'clock Sunday morning, and I was shaky. So I decided I'd have a couple of beers and drink a little bit of the moonshine that I still had, and just to calm myself, and then I would go. I lost track of what I was supposed to be doing. I thought I was drinking again, you know, and I ended up getting drunk. And I go, I passed out. I woke up, and I did it again. And I passed out, and I woke up, and I did it again. And I'm like, I can't keep it together long enough to go here for 2 hours. 2 hours, that's it. You know, so I called my brother, who's in the program. And I was like, Ben, I need you to come with me to finish this little job. And I told him what it was, and he's like, you can't do that. I was like, no, I can do the work if I could just get there. There's 5 liquor stores between my house and the job, but I can't make it past all of them. So I went and got him, and he said, is the world going to end if you don't finish this job today? I said, no, but it probably will tomorrow. He said, let's go to an AA meeting. You know, I started crying. I'm like, all right, whatever. That's not what I'm asking for, but I had heard him talking about meetings, you know. My brother went to prison and went to AA meetings in county jail trying to get a bond reduction, and it didn't work. And then he went to prison, and they gave him straight time, but he thought if he would go to these AA meetings, you know, the judge would see how good he was doing. He'd let him out early. It didn't work. But my brother is one of us. And while he was sitting in those AA meetings, he picked up a sponsor, and he started working the steps. And he became free on the inside before he ever got out. So he worked with me for probably 10 months or so when he got out, before I stopped drinking. He got out in August, and I know he got out in October, and then I got sober the following June. So I went to the AA meeting, and I picked up a white chip. And I would like to say that that was the last drink I took, but it wasn't. Because I was sick, you know, and when I got home, I started shaking, and I had to have something to drink. I had to have it. So I nursed a little bit of the whiskey I had left. I drank a couple of beers, and my wife detoxed me at home. And I did wake up the next day, and as sick and as shaky and as scared as I was, I went to a meeting. And then the next day, I went to a meeting, and I went to a meeting. And I was like really liking the things that I was hearing in the meetings. And they said, go to a meeting at the time you're most likely to drink. And I was like, that was just like when I was awake, you know, like when I was conscious, I was drinking. I think sometimes I could pass out with a beer between my legs and still drink it and not even realize it, you know. But so I'm like 30 days sober. And my wife quits drinking because she's the good wife, not because she's an alcoholic. And I'm going to these meetings, and I'm learning something about peace, and I'm learning something about serenity, and I'm feeling all kind of warm and fuzzy inside, like when I leave. And then I go home, and there's this woman there with untreated alcoholism, and I was miserable. And all we do is scream and fight, F you this, F you that, this ridiculous. And I'm like, I totally forgot everything I just heard in that AA meeting. So I packed all my stuff up, my clothes, real discreetly, and then I shifted them all out to the door in my truck, and I went to live with my dad, who has 40 bottles of liquor on a shelf and 10 cases of beer stacked up outside of the fridge. I thought I was less likely to drink living there than I was with my wife, who was not trying to do anything about her problem. So she's like, what are we going to do? And I kept hearing stuff in the meetings about, you should stay out of a relationship for a year. You know, so I tell her, I'm like, we'll have to reevaluate this in a year. And she's like, am I supposed to wait for a year? I said, I don't know what you're supposed to do. I was like, but right now, I'm doing what I need to do. You know, I'm serious. I want to stop drinking. You know, I picked up 1,000 invisible white chips prior to getting to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got to AA, I found that little piece of something that I had been looking for. You know, I had, in my first 90 days, I went to over 300 meetings. People say, how do you do that? Did you not work? Yeah, I did work, but there's a 5:45, an 8 o'clock, and a 10 o'clock every single day. And if I got rained out of work, I was at an 11 o'clock and a 1 o'clock too. And on the weekends, I was in 5 to 6 meetings both days, and 3 to 4 meetings on the weekdays. In my first year, I attended over 1,000 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just after my first year, I had the pleasure of going to the International. I volunteered down there. I went to the Atlanta Men's Workshop last March. That forever changed my life. You know, I came in and I started working the steps, and I was like, you know, 1, 2, 3, boom, boom, I got it. You know, people kept talking about a sponsor. I'm like, I don't need a sponsor. I'm like, I got 1, 2, 3, like right now. I mean, like the first day. You know, I didn't realize if I worked the steps off the wall, I was going to have an off the wall program. You know, so I got to the 4th step and I didn't even know how to go about doing it. So I kept trying to listen, you know, and thinking that I would catch enough information about the 4th step in the meetings to be able to go and do it by myself. And, you know, I'm like 30 some days sober, and all of a sudden, like, I'm off this pink cloud and I just hit a wall. So I get a sponsor, and my sponsor is like, you're on step 1 for 2 weeks. I'm like, 2 weeks? And I'm like, I'm already at 3. He's like, not with me, you're 8. And I was like, all right. So, you know, I had hope when I got to step 2. I had the hope. You know, I seen it in my brother. I believe that could happen for me too. I had been to jail. I'd had jailhouse religion. That wasn't the case here. You know, he didn't have jailhouse religion. Something changed. I had jailhouse religion, and I was drinking a beer in the car when I was leaving the parking lot of the jail. You know, I left that there. He had something. You know, and I got to step 3. I was like, okay, so how do I really do step 3? Step 3 is a decision to go on with the rest of the steps. I'm going to turn my will and my life, which is my thinking and my actions, over the care of God as I understand Him. Which I didn't understand much, but I believe that there was something there. And the rest of the steps was going to teach me how to turn my will and my life over. I got into that 4th step and I sat there. Like, I went through and I wrote my first 3 columns out, like, in the first night. Took them to my sponsor and I was like, look, man, you know, I was all proud of myself. You know, I was seeking validation, you know, for doing it so fast. And he's like, this is really good stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I'm like, I have a lot of assholes in my life. And he's like, now it's time to look at your part. And I sat in it for the next 2.5 months, wondering how I was going to get around doing this. And everything I heard in the meetings, you know, was like, you know, I heard people go back out when they don't do a thorough 4th and 5th. You know, I was hearing that stuff. I started to believe that I was no exception to the rule. You know, it hadn't happened to me yet. I learned an analogy for that. You're eligible too. You know, it hadn't happened yet. So I went ahead and I finished doing it. Anybody that had never worked the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could have shown them all that stuff in those first 3 columns and they'd have signed off on my bullshit in a heartbeat. You know? Because a lot of things that I did, I put myself in a position to be hurt. You know? I would cover a bad motive with a good deed and think that I was a good guy. You know? That was just the kind of stuff I did. I got to 6 and 7, and I was like, you know, these are going to be the easy ones. It didn't sound like much work, you know. So, like, I did it how my sponsor told me to do it. and we went on to 8 and 9, and I was making amends. And as I'm making amends, I really got a better understanding what 6 and 7 was all about. Because I find myself making amends to people, and then find myself doing some of the same stuff I did that I had to make those amends. And I'm like, oh my God, 6 and 7 is not that easy. You know, it was an eye-opener for me. And so I have made all of my personal amends. I used to use the hospital as a free clinic. You know, I would just go in, they have to treat you. I'd never pay any of the bills. I'm paying off all those. I paid off credit cards. I paid off banks that I wrote bad checks at. You know, I've paid off, I'm paying off a bank that I had a delinquent account for that is so old that they can't even put it on my credit and they can't sue me. But the question is how free does Ray want to be? You know, they're not trying to take my money. They just want theirs. You know, it was their money to begin with. And I'm trying to live a new kind of way. So I pay them. You know, I'm down to a few. I'll have a couple of them, like 2 of the last 3 paid off in the next couple of months. And the other one, if I keep making the minimum payments, it'll be about 10 years. So once I get some of those other ones out of the way, maybe I'll pay a little more to that one. But I'm doing it. And the promises came true. My economic insecurities left me because now I can buy something, put it in my name, and nobody's going to take it from me. You know, 10, 11, and 12, I just try to do the best of my ability every day. You know, what does my life look like today? I know I'm about out of time here, so everything is different. When I was about 90 days sober, about 65, 75 days sober, something like that, I kept driving by this bar and I kept seeing my other car there, which tells me that my wife is in the bar. And I knew she wanted to be back with me. So I kind of slipped into a little bit of old behavior. And I called her and I said, hey, you want to go to a speaker meeting with me tonight? And she was like, I'll think about it. She called me back in a few minutes. She's like, I'll go. So every Saturday night for the next couple of months, we went to a speaker meeting together. And some woman told her story. And I asked her, I said, have you ever considered working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? She's like, it's funny you ask, you know, I've been kind of thinking about that. She asked this woman to be her sponsor. She got sober. She now sponsors other women. And as of August 15th, my whole family is back together. I have my kids in my house. I have my own house. We've got 3 bedrooms. The kids have separate rooms. You know, they have a game room in the basement. We've got a fenced-in backyard and 2 cats. You know, and I don't buy them the cheapest cat food nor the cheapest litter, and I buy them those little cans and bags of treats and all that stuff too. You know, these are things that I would never have done before because that would have cut into my drinking money. My cats actually get their shots and they're fixed, you know, and all these things. You know, I'm like a responsible pet owner. You know. It's unbelievable. I used to go out and I bought a yard sign one time and I'd go do a little job and I'd put it in somebody's front yard and I said I had a business. Today, I actually have my own LLC. You know, the company is slowly but surely growing. I stay very busy. God, of my understanding, knows how important it is for me to stay in recovery. You know, now that my family's back together, I don't have the freedoms to go to all the meetings like I did before. But he has blessed me with a contract for a company called Sober Man Living out of Kennesaw, and they've got 12 treatment houses, and I do all of the maintenance work in all of them. And that constantly keeps me in contact with the newcomer. I could be on a job site and sit down at 9 a.m. in one of the treatment houses and join the meeting. Yeah. And that's just totally, I mean, it's amazing. You know, I'm blessed with so many great things today. You know, like we on Thanksgiving, like we made a gratitude wreath, and each one of us wrote something on 5 leaves and put it on there. And both of my kids, the 2 older ones, their thing that they was happy for, grateful for, was their home, because the first time in their life they had Thanksgiving dinner at their own house, and Daddy wasn't drunk. You know, it's just I've got a life second to none. You know, like I just love this. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. You know, I'm not supposed to be here today, you know, with multiple high-speed chases with the police and crashing and all the things that I've done. I am so lucky to be alive, let alone stand in this room in front of you guys tonight and tell you that you don't ever have to feel that way if you're still feeling bad. That there is a way out. You know, trust me, I'm proof. My name is Ray. I'm a real alcoholic. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Ray. You made our day. Ms. Jay, would you hand out the chips for us? They're all laid out right here.
Hi, I'm Janine, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you very much for your story. Great stuff. Great stuff. Anyways, if he can do it, I think anybody else in here can do it. We have a chip system here in Atlanta, and the chips don't keep you sober. That they do mark your time and sobriety. The first chip we offer is a white chip. Anybody want to surrender and pick up a white chip? All right. We have a sober chip for 30 days, 3 months, 6 months. Anybody who's celebrating 9 months? Anybody celebrating a year or multiples of years? Oh, man, I'm blanked out. Any second thoughts on the white chip? All right, if you have a year or more of sobriety, raise your hand. All right, see how it works. All right. All right, thanks, everybody.
Okay, well, come back next week. We got chips. We have plenty left.
There's a lot of things going right. People needing, but they doing without. While others living high, a big piece of the pie, so many they got it wrong. As for me, when I wanted too much, ain't never enough. Myself, hide it from everyone else, save it for a rainy day. If you wanna have it all the time, gotta give it away. Thought I had me love, kept it on. If you want love all the time, give it to someone else. I want everyone around to see just how much your love means to me. Baby, wear it on my sleeve.